Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 227, Reclaiming Your Real Self with Rick Johnson. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So what makes it unique, spiritually oriented counseling or psychotherapy unique, is that it includes spirituality as a co-therapist. And that's really how I think about it. It's, you know, the belief that when clients tune into what I call a life-affirming spiritual practice, that it really is about, and that I don't define that. Clients define that. That's an individually defined, you know, very personal thing. But the factor I work with clients is to the level of which it's life-affirming. So a life-affirming, personally chosen spiritual practice is a co-therapist in therapy. And I've gotten to the place where, you know, I agree with Jung. It's more powerful than therapy alone.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Rick Johnson. Dr. Rick Johnson has a PhD in counseling psychology from New Mexico State University, as well as master's and postmaster's training in marriage and family therapy from the University of Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic. He's currently associate professor and department chair of counselor education at Portland State University. Previously, he was an assistant associate professor at Montana State University. Rick's research and scholarly agenda focuses on family systems theory and the effects of family experiences on psychosocial development in adolescence and adulthood, as well as the integration of psychological and spiritual health. His research has led to over 20 published articles in professional journals. He recently published a book, Reclaiming Your Real Self, A Psychological and Spiritual Integration. Rick is a licensed psychologist in Oregon and a clinical member of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. He maintains an active practice in the Portland, Oregon area, focusing on couples and family therapy as well as individual adult psychotherapy. His theoretical orientation is an integration of family systems, relational, psychodynamic, and humanistic existential. Now, let's go to the interview. Dr. Rick Johnson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so pleased to have you on the show. You've written a book titled Reclaiming Your Real Self, A Psychological and Spiritual Integration. This idea that we somehow have lost touch with our real self seems to crop up in a lot of different psychological and spiritual theories. And in fact, you step through a number of psychological theories looking at this notion of the lost real self. So maybe we can go through some of those now, and perhaps you could start us off with Freud.
Sure. Well, as I know you know, Dr. Dave, Freud was not particularly interested in spirituality or psychology or religion. He was quite critical of it, and his early writings had the idea of the ego, which was primarily defensive in nature. The ego was managing anxiety between the id and the superego.
Right.
But certainly in his later writings, the ego started to have more of its own motivations. It was able to test the environment to see if it was safe to drop defenses. And it really set the stage for the idea that the ego is a part of us that is actively has its own wisdoms and motivations, not just responding to the motivations of the id, but it's its own kind of health-based motivations. And that idea, which I think Freud's later writings kind of set the stage for, is certainly a great starting point to talk about that we have this potential within us to know what's right for us, or that can start to move in a positive direction in the world rather than just responding to the id impulses and needs.
But does Freud have this idea of us having a false self, a kind of a false self with a truer, more authentic self that needs to be reclaimed?
Well, I'm not so sure he went that far. I mean, you could jump in here as well, Dave, and your readings about it. I'm not so sure he went that far. You know, I think his idea was through analysis we could work, kind of reduce neurotic suffering by maybe becoming more authentic, stripping away defenses. But certainly we weren't going to, it was the humanists who really came on and said that there is more of a core of wisdom and transcendent potentialities within us that we can kind of work through defenses to kind of get to and burst into health. Whereas I think Freud was more moderated in his or cautious in his belief that we could be that joyous. I mean, I think Freud was thought that we could reduce suffering through awareness and analysis.
Yes.
And kind of be less neurotic and more aware, live a more aware life.
He was sort of the view that way deep down we needed to be civilized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And rather than that there's some sort of innate core of goodness, that rather we're little beasties that need to be tamed. But I do think that your idea that sort of on the analytic couch there is this sense of reclaiming maybe a truer, a less neurotic, as you point out, self.
Mm-hmm.
So what about Jung? You move on from Freud in your book to talk about Jung, and Jung put a different spin on this idea, didn't he? The idea of a real underlying self.
I think the part of Jung's theory, or several parts that are really highlight these ideas, and the first is the idea of the self archetype, that we do have this part of us that strives for meaning and deeper meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that much of life is devoted to trying to survive, continue to work through this personal story of what he called the ego. It was a little different view of ego than what Freud had. The ego is more of our consciousness of self and this personal story of self that's developed from early on and throughout our lives, and that much of our life, at least the first half of our lives, we really struggle to survive, and we work and we compensate based on those early experiences, and we get restricted in this idea of ourselves in the world, this personal story. But the self with a capital S, the self archetype, is this part of us that has real access to a deeper pools of knowledge, that is striving for something beyond just surviving and staying in the same old restrictive compensatory ways, and that's staying within that personal story and sort of saying there's something transcendent here about life and about being that is different than this personal story. It's more impactful in that Jung said that we strive for that primarily through religion or spiritual means, because that's a way to access that deeper meaning. And of course, he also has the concept of the collective unconscious, or the transpersonal consciousness, this larger inherited evolutionary pool of knowledge that is kind of with us all, that's possible for us all, the sense of that many times comes through symbols and other kinds of nonlinear experiences that point to deeper wisdom and deeper knowing, and that we have kind of our best chance to access that collective unconscious through the self. The self, again, is that part of us that is really striving for deeper meaning outside of the box that gets created by the personal story of our lives and how we're supposed to live it.
As I hear you speaking, I'm thinking of his term individuation.
Yes.
And which is really about, I mean, it fits in well with the title of your book, Reclaiming Your Real Self, in as much as I think individuation refers to, through the process of Jungian analysis, getting in touch with one's uniqueness, separating yeah. oneself from the crowd, from the group.
And don't you think it's also meaning integration? You know, integrating of our various parts of ourselves,
yes.
including our shadow parts, the parts that are we consciously wish we weren't. You know, and that we, you know, would banish.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you're right. It is the coming of together of who we are and an integration of the variety of parts. So it's a much more sustainable, more meaningful sense of self, which tends to happen through spiritual practice. And Jung talked about that spiritual practice many times is more powerful than analysis alone.
I'm trying to keep our focus for now on the psychological part, because I'm chopping things
sure.
up artificially, and then we'll move into looking at the spiritual
sounds great
part of it. Another thing that strikes me about Jung, because you talk about the search for meaning, which, you know, Jungian psychology is very much about, and I think there's also a sense of purpose in there, that is of destiny, that Jung feels that each of us has some the seed of something that's unique and special. And so his psychology is, I can't think of the right word, it's prospective as opposed to just being focused on the past. Because he felt, my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I wouldn't call myself a Jungian scholar, with quotes around the word scholar. But my impression is that he felt that there is a future that's kind of drawing us forward.
Yes, like a purpose that is helps make us unique within the world, within our lives.
Yes, definitely.
And that is connected to a larger wisdom.
Now, moving along, there's a place in your book where you talk about object relations and attachment theory. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how do those notions play with the idea of reclaiming your true self?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the object relations and, you know, attachment theorists and interpersonal theorists are going to focus on the idea, first and foremost, that we need people. And that we are drawn to, well, you know, we're not like gazelles born on the African savanna where we can drop out, you know, and a minute after being born we can be galloping across the savanna.
Right.
We are born completely dependent, and that we need to be able to develop relationships in order to survive. And so that has pretty great consequences for us psychologically in the development of who we are, that ourselves, our very self-concept, our very idea of who we are at a core level, a basic level of survival, is contingent upon how we are relationally. And so our very sense of self, the blueprints and the foundation for who we are, the patterned ways of being, and just the very sense of who we are is based on those relational interactions, the interactional sequences, the minute to the large ones, really dictate basically who we become. And these ideas are being supported by research in interpersonal neurobiology that are talking about the kind of mirroring experiences that we have throughout childhood in particular and beyond that not only affect us psychologically, but our brain development, our very sense of who we are. So we develop a sense of who we are and a whole toolbox of interpersonal ways of being, or interpersonal strategies, you might call them, to first and foremost maintain connections with caregivers that can take care of us. And so over time, this is what, from this theoretical theoretical standpoints, this is the ideas of who we are become intertwined with our learned ways of operating interpersonally. Okay? And the good news is that with relatively healthy parenting, we can develop stable sense of self and be able to imagine parents or caregivers that are caring for us, which builds our sense of self-esteem and helps us learn how to self-soothe, so that when we're not in contact with others, we have the courage and the sense of efficacy to be able to go out in the world and develop mastery and autonomy as we have the ability to self-soothe and return to kind of a home base within us, a sense of I'm okay, or there I am as I go out into the world. And unfortunately, what happens under less than optimal parenting conditions, we develop more and more restrictive or compensatory ways of operating. So we move away from that grounded sort of home base within us to be more reactive and restrictive in our interpersonal strategies. And certainly, as I talk about in my book, that's one of the problems that develops, is people, their consciousness becomes more wrapped up in these interpersonal strategies than in more of a grounded sense of self.
So it's when people don't get adequate mirroring or don't have an adequate sort of attachment experience, mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. that's when sort of reclaiming a true self, or maybe even developing a truer self, comes mm-hmm. into play.
Yes, I think that's a big part of it, and it's the type of mirroring they get, because we all get some mirroring, and it might be absent mirroring or dismissive mirroring. So it's certainly not enough quality mirroring, and mirroring that reflects back to us a sense of worthlessness or shame or that's disregardful in some level is going to prompt a more defensive response. We're going to need to more urgently figure out why that's happening and how we can, so it develops a more reactive or restrictive compensatory consciousness, if you will.
Boy, I just saw a movie that comes to mind as I hear you talk about this. I don't know if you've seen it yet. It's called Precious.
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, boy. I recommend it to you and all of my listeners. It's a very, very powerful film about a young African-American teenage girl who's pregnant mm-hmm. and in poverty, etc. But the mirroring, quotes, that she gets from her mother is just absolutely destructive. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't find a better example, if you wanted mm-hmm. to teach students of how destructive that can be. It's a wonderful film. It's probably going to get an Academy Award, so keep your eye out for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned the humanistic perspective, which is one that I've been identified with in my career. And one of the people you cover is Carl Rogers. So mm-hmm. how do Carl Rogers and the humanists come deal with this notion of reclaiming the real self?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of Carl Rogers, and just watched one of his videos again for the thousandth time with students in one of my classes the other night.
And me too. I've watched those videos thousands mm-hmm. of times as well. Are you talking about the Gloria?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I have to admit, I still like it. I mean, yes. I know he's been criticized for being so non-directive, sort of maddeningly so in that video, but I just think he's a master in the subtlety of his work, and he just truly believes that we know what's right for us, that he, as a therapist, can't possibly, it's very destructive to think that he would know what's right for someone else, that he steadfastly believes that we all have that inner wisdom, that when we can quiet the external noise and challenge what he called conditions of worth being conditions that are placed upon an individual, for example, saying you're only worthy if you get good grades or become become something, practice a certain religion or do something, that's the only, you must accomplish these conditions to be worthy, that that messes people up. It gets them knocked off of, they start trading in their inner wisdom, what they know is right for them, and kind of, you know, in a way ties into what you were saying before about Jung's idea of this, that we really have a plan or a path, or there's a purpose moving forward in our lives, that if we're busy trying to please other people and live up to their conditions, our energy is now externally reactive. We're basing it on what other people think we should do, rather than quieting that noise long enough to really listen to what's right for us. And obviously, in his perspective, the therapist's job is to help the client do that, help the client kind of quiet the noise enough to come in and turn inward, be self-reflective, and therefore increase connection with that inner wisdom, that sense of clarity about that feeling of, yeah, that feels right to me. And, you know, I wanted to just go back to Karen Horney's theory. She's one of the interpersonalists, and I actually named the book, Reclaiming Your Real Self, after her concept, the real self. And Karen Horney is called a psychoanalytic humanist because she believed in this idea of this, the motivation and the wisdom of our real or authentic self, or our, what I sometimes call our natural self, like who we would be under relatively optimal parenting and life circumstances, the consciousness that would rise to the top of awareness. That's who we would be. That's the life trajectory, is the real self. And it, so it brings in that humanistic idea. It integrates that that idea quite well. And then Karen Horney contrasts that with these compensatory selves or interpersonal positions that we get into in our lives. For example, being more hiding or withdrawing in our lives, or being, you know, someone who wants to fight and be reactive in their lives, or others who are more ingratiating in their lives. These are interpersonal positions that can really develop into kind of personality types. But unfortunately, they're moving us away from that inner wisdom that Karen Horney and Carl Rogers talk about.
You know, I seem to recall that Carl Rogers used the metaphor of an onion, which really gets at that idea that there's an inner core with all of these layers surrounding it, and that, I believe that he thought that his approach of treating people with unconditional positive regard, which we could think of in the mirroring terms that you talked about before, of really holding kind of a loving, positive mirror up to the client.
Right.
That
right.
Somehow that gives rise to then the person being able to maybe peel their own onion, if you will, or to go mm-hmm. deeper into the layers.
Yes, yes. You know, just to digress a little bit, I watched a DVD the other night of Leslie Greenberg's emotion-focused therapy. And, man, boy, did he just really provide that kind of mirroring that you're talking about, just really staying with the client and mirroring back their experience, including the complexity of their experience, all really designed to help turn them inward to develop that awareness of what really is right. It was one of the best sort of humanistic therapy sessions I've seen in a while.
You know, I don't recognize his name.
Leslie Greenberg wrote, he does emotion-focused therapy. It's an experiential-based model, and he and Susan Johnson created emotionally-focused couples therapy, an attachment-based model. It's just lovely stuff.
Well, great. I'll have to try to follow up on that, or maybe
yeah.
you can send me an email and I'll add him to my long and growing list of potential mm-hmm. guests. You know, when I got started doing this podcasting, you know, I just thought, well, I know some people who I could maybe interview.
Mm-hmm.
And it very quickly networked out to, you know, way beyond the people that uh-huh. that I personally know. And it's just amazing how many people are out there that really need to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm chipping away at this.
Well, I'm glad you included me.
Yeah, well, definitely, definitely. Okay, now we get to the place that you've been trying to go to, the spiritual part. The subtitle of your book refers to a psychological and spiritual integration. So what led you to want to bring in a spiritual component?
Well, there's sort of a short answer to that one and a long answer.
Well, we've got plenty of time.
I'll follow your lead on the time here because, you know, the first part of that is I've been teaching these counseling theories for many years and just struck by as we're talking about it, these theories that point not only to our inner wisdom but point to the possibility that spirituality could be connected to that. Now, psychology and spirituality have a sordid history, which
right.
I don't know if we have time to get into, but they, you know, even many of the theories, other than maybe Jung, haven't really embraced spiritual ideas. They keep talking about it in psychological language, and yet I kept seeing this link between, let's just say, the real self, that authentic part of us that has that inner wisdom, with ideas of spirituality. And certainly Jung provides a real nice link there. But I started to, you know, I've been a practicing therapist for over 20 years as well, and worked with many, many people of a variety of issues and socioeconomic status. And what I found that sort of cuts across that is this idea that people do seem to know what's right for them. And when they're practicing having certain experiences that I would start to say, broadly speaking, are spiritual, that seemed to help them have access to that inner wisdom. So whether it was someone who went horseback riding, or somebody went walking on the beach, or someone who took a hike, or was walking along next to a stream, or was in prayer, that they would come in and talk about that if they realized I was open to it, as a lot of therapists aren't, but I very much am, that would be a way to connect to that inner wisdom. And so, of course, I've had my own history, so I'll just share just a few kind of personal stories around this and how the book then developed.
Yeah, we'd be interested in that.
Okay. I started to have, you know, probably, you know, it took me 4 years to write the book, but I had a series of experiences that happened that basically led me to get the book outlined in a week. I went from a vague idea of a book to it all just coming together. And some of it was just feelings of deep gratitude. I kept having these experiences after seeing clients in my private practice where I would feel filled with gratitude. And that there was some, it felt like an energy, like a warm light that was in my body or with me around this feeling of gratitude, just feeling so thankful that I get to do this wonderful therapy work and be in this relationship and that with my clients. And it wasn't just that I'm giving to them, they're giving to me. And it's the exchange in the relationship itself that I was feeling moved and touched and changed by. And I was feeling just so grateful for it. And right around this time, I went to a poetry reading in Portland. And it was by a jazz musician and a poet by the name of Anson Wright. And it was not something I typically do, go to poetry readings, but it felt like something was coming through a different channel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so intellectual usually in writing, and this was a heart-based thing, and this
yes.
was something different. And I just sat there open to this different kind of channel and energy that was happening. And as I was driving home, I had that really deep experience of gratitude again, and I just started crying. I started bawling my eyes out with joy.
Yes.
And I pulled my car over, and I just felt this warm light and energy. And I mean, I'm not trying to get too spooky on you or anything, but it was a really powerful spiritual experience. And
yes.
it was this sense of that there's more to life than meets the eye. And when we can open up other kinds of more heart-based channels, wow, there's some real energy here. And so what came to me, I called it spiritual energy. And then basically in that moment of weeping, this idea of the real self is the same thing as the spiritual energy, or at least the real self has access to spiritual energy. There was some connection there. And that's what came to me, and I basically said, I'm going to write a book, and this is what this book is going to be about. And literally, it felt like it just poured through me. David, for a week, all I did was write on everything, little scraps of pieces of paper I could get my hands on. It literally just poured out of me, and it was these ideas of the real self and of the connection between spirituality and the real self. And like I said, it took me 4 years to actually get it into a publishable form, but it was because I don't have a lot of time. But that first week, I really thought I might be having a manic episode or something. The good news was I was sleeping, so I was pretty sure I wasn't having a manic episode. But I was clearly lit up by these spiritual experience.
Well, this is fascinating. I'm so glad that you shared that. It sounds like you had a really spontaneous breakthrough, the kind of thing that I think Maslow talked about when he talked about peak experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, many people seek that sort of thing through meditation or prayer or some spiritual practice. Had you been engaged in any practice like that, or was this really just out of the blue for you?
Well, I mean, I've been a seeker my whole life, and I can tell you some stories about the things my mother tells me I've said as a kid, as I was seeking, and I've always been very interested in spiritual and religious ideas and philosophical ideas, even as a young kid. But there's been quite a path for me in my own. You know, I was raised Catholic, and then went through a period of pushing away all of that, and then I really adopted a Buddhist practice, and I've been meditating for about 30 years. One of the things that I do regularly that's very nourishing for me is I belong to a Buddhism and psychotherapy study group.
Okay.
And it's a group of psychologists here in Portland, and it's just so wonderful. And many of the ideas in my book also were nourished and percolated and supported in that context, as I would bring in ideas and we would, you know, talk about them and challenge them.
Yeah, so there was a kind of groundwork that had been laid for this kind of experience to happen. I'm curious about what your mother said about what you said when you were a child.
Well, she would say things like, I would ask about time and space. And, you know, so if I've been to this tree once and I come back the next day, is the tree the same or is the tree different? And she said, I asked that in kindergarten, and she said she didn't know how to answer the question. She said, well, I think it's the same. And I'd say, well, how can it be exactly the same? And am I the same? And so I was already, I think, fussing with ideas of impermanence and, you know, what is a self and a no self, and are we connected to what's around us? And I remember distinctly having flashes, glimpses into the future, and I would tell my mother about it, and, you know, eerily, a lot of things that I would say would come true within the next week or two, things that I would sort of say, hey, has this happened? And then we'd find out a week later in the news that something happened. I remember there was something with George Harrison when I was a kid, and I had something about the Beatles, and lo and behold, it came true. And again, I don't want to be spooky about all that, but I do believe that I think all of us have the ability to access that collective unconscious, or something that's beyond just the normal linear way that we think about life, the kind of the dual way that we think about life.
Well, I certainly believe that too, and I've had my own experiences, mostly through dreams, where something will happen in a dream, and then something very synchronistically happens the next day. And that's one kind of personal experience that I've had quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but one of the things that really spurred that development for me and as a young adult was noticing coincidences and thinking about synchronicity, you know, this idea of synchronicity, and just really starting to work with that idea. Is there some intentional energy that's around us that's, and, you know, is that similar or different than what people talk about God, and how do we think about that those coincidences, and can we influence them and tap into them? And so that was definitely a part of opening to the possibilities of something beyond rational thinking.
Yes. Now, I know you've listened to, on occasion, you've listened to Shrink Wrap Radio. There's an episode that you might not have heard that I think you'd be very interested in. I have a good friend in New Hampshire who wrote a book called The Soul of Counseling. He's also, like yourself, involved in counselor education. Mm-hmm. And so he, too, wanted – his name is Dwight Webb, and I interviewed him in Shrink Wrap Radio number 68. And he, too, was reaching for a way to integrate the spiritual dimension into counseling theory. So you might want to take a look at his book or listen to that podcast.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Well, I love your personal stories, and I'm glad that we were able to get into some of those. Let's see, coming back to coming back to some of the things I've got written down here. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I may be able to help with the segue back.
Yeah, great.
Would be, so I started having these experiences, or more of them. I mean, obviously, as I've talked about, I've had spiritual experiences throughout my life, but these were kind of rapid fire ones that I was having related to clients, and then this poetry reading and this idea of this coming together. But I must admit, I mean, I'm a psychologist. I'm trained that way, and I felt like, you know, I don't have a degree in theology or something, and you know, even though I've been studying philosophy and religion for years myself, I thought, I need to do some research here, or, you know, some other way to kind of validate what's happening to me and these thoughts that I'm having. I'm not sure how it'll be received by the psychological community if I tell them this just happened through a poetry reading. So let me, let me do some research. So over, about a year period, I would call it kind of loose qualitative research, but I asked about 100 people three questions. I asked them, what is your definition of spirituality? How do you experience spirituality? And how do you access spirituality in your life? And I really tried to do it very open-ended so that I could get a common person's thematically based, because what I wanted to do was pool these ideas together and combine them with the insights that I was having and had developed over the years, to really help be a accessible way of viewing spirituality that wasn't related to any particular faith or religious position.
Well, what did you find out?
What I found out was a few things. First is it's really personal. You know the old adage, you know, you don't talk about this with polite company.
Uh-huh.
It takes a little while for people to think you're not going to judge them, and but once they relax and realize you really are interested, it is a unique experience. It's very personal and very unique. So going back to that Jungian concept of our uniqueness and our place in the world, everybody's got a story, and everybody has had some level of spiritual experiences. And so I have just found it to be amazingly rich, certainly talking about it with my clients. But so it's very personal, and some people are quite protective of their belief system. Some equate religion and spirituality, others do not. Everybody is comfortable with certain language and not as comfortable with other language. I really found out that words matter. So if first one person says God, another person doesn't like God. They want to use life force, or, you know, and where I've come to is I'm open to it all. It doesn't really matter to me whether someone says God or Jesus or life force or, you know, synchronicity or interconnecting energy. I've come to believe that we're all talking about the same thing, and I don't get reactive around those words, but many, many people are.
Yes.
Primarily because of the kind of life experiences that they've had, that they've been told one way or another, this is the right way or that's not the right way, and it's created reactivity for them around the conversation, which is very important and instructive for us as therapists. We need to understand the power of the words and really meet clients where they are with their words and work through our own reactivity around those words, what I call being differentiated spiritually, or spiritually differentiated, is to be able to be kind of manage our own reactivity and come to a place of balance with these, so that we're not projecting that our own reactivity onto our clients, but we can meet them with whatever words they use.
Well, this segues nicely into the last chapter of your book on spiritually oriented psychotherapy. So maybe you could talk about, you know, what you would regard spiritually oriented psychotherapy to be, you know, what might psychotherapists maybe who are listening to us who want to move more in that direction.
Well, first, I think spiritually oriented psychotherapy uses the same factors as normal psychotherapy or effective psychotherapy in general, which is all the same elements, the common factors of psychotherapy across models, I think, is what we should really be focusing in on, not so much on technique. I'm one of those who really buys into the common factors. You know, what are the aspects of therapy that are effective? First and foremost, relationship.
Right.
And I don't know if we want to go in that direction, but maybe there'll be time later to talk more about that. But basically utilizing the aspects of therapy, you know, the relationship, insight, awareness, the relationship both as a sense of a team and a home base with the client, but also a sense of corrective, the psychodynamic ideas of it being able to be a corrective relationship or practicing new things. So what makes it unique, spiritually oriented counseling or psychotherapy unique, is that it includes spirituality as a co-therapist. And that's really how I think about it. It's, you know, the belief that when clients tune into what I call a life-affirming spiritual practice, that it really is about, and that I don't define that. Clients define that. That's an individually defined, you know, very personal thing. But the factor I work with clients is to the level at which it's life-affirming. So a life-affirming, personally chosen spiritual practice is a co-therapist in therapy. And I've gotten to the place where, you know, I agree with Jung, it's more powerful than therapy alone.
Hmm.
When clients can tap into that, it's sort of like it's a wonderful resource, because that spiritual practice, if it's life-affirming, tunes them into their real self, tunes them into what they know is right for them, helps them in their decision-making, it builds their sense of personal integrity. In the book, I spend some amount of time talking about what is personal integrity. And, you know, I mean, I've basically believed that that's really all we have in life. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we have to live our lives based on what we know is right for us, our personal integrity, and have the courage to, and the, you know, convictions to stand by that. And we do the best we can. That's what I tell my kids. You know, we do the best we can in life. As long as you're trying to live your life based on that personal integrity, you know, that's it. You know, we're all just swimming in this weird soup,
right?
trying to figure out the meaning and how to you know, pay the mortgage and, you know, keep our heads afloat, or pay the rent and have meaningful relationships and meaningful activities. We're all trying to figure what it's all about, and I think the guiding light or energy is that our integrity, our own, the real self. And when that real self is connected to a spiritual practice that's life-affirming, it is going to help a great deal. And I think about doing therapy without it is sort of like, you know, you're running naked in the streets. You're missing some major components here. Having a life-affirming spiritual or philosophical grounding is, I think, essential to effective human functioning.
Well, I hate to bring you up short, but, you know, I think that's a wonderful place for us to close. That's a wonderful statement for us to end on. So, Dr. Rick Johnson, it's been my pleasure to get to meet you in this way, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was great. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this conversation with Dr. Rick Johnson as much as I did having it. I thought he really caught fire when he started talking about the experiences of extreme gratitude that led him to write this book. As you heard me remark, his description of being overwhelmed by a sense of gratitude to the point of tears really seem to exemplify what Abraham Maslow described as a peak experience. As Maslow, one of the pioneers of the humanistic psychology movement, wrote in 1971, the highest peaks include, quotes, feelings of limitless horizons opening up to the vision, the feeling of being, simultaneously more powerful and also more helpless than one ever was before, the feeling of great ecstasy and wonder and awe, the loss of placing in time and space, end quote. And this seems to capture something of what Rick was describing for us. In fact, this sort of peak experience is one of eight characteristics that with which Maslow defined the process of self-actualization. And I underscore here that self-actualization is a process rather than an actual point at which one ever arrives. But of the eight characteristics that he listed, of which peak experience is one, first he listed concentration, by which he meant a kind of absorption. I think it would be the same as what Csikszentmihalyi has later written about in terms of flow. Another is that the self-actualizing person makes growth choices, chooses growth, chooses to take risks rather than to stay in the comfort zone. The third one is self-awareness, which makes me think of the whole interest today in mindfulness and mindfulness meditation. The fourth one that Maslow talks about is honesty, that is taking responsibility for your actions. The fifth one is judgment, and he thinks that this involves making better life choices, making the right life choices in one's progress towards self-actualization, the right choices in terms of marriage and career and how to use one's time. The sixth factor was self-development, self-actualization. This continual process involves a way of continually living, working, and relating to the world rather than to a single accomplishment, working on oneself, developing one's capabilities. And the seventh one that he mentions is peak experiences that particularly seem to characterize those people that he saw as transcending self-actualizers. And the final characteristic that he mentions is a lack of ego defenses, so that we reduce the amount to which we distort our images of ourselves and of the external world through repression, projection, and other defenses. These are goals to which we all can aspire. And I think you'll agree that my guest, Dr. Rick Johnson, seems to be well along the way.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
I can tell you what's all in my mind is gratitude to all you listeners for being such a supportive and enthusiastic audience. It's your devotion to this undertaking that's kept me going this past year, for the past 5 years, really, and which will keep me going in this next one. Happy New Year, everybody. Here's hoping that 2010 brings more peace and prosperity to the planet. Whether or not that wish comes true, my other wish is that 2010 brings you more inner peace and a greater appreciation for the wealth within. That's a wish that I think is within our power for each one of us to manifest. May it be so. If you heard an ad at the beginning of this podcast, what they call a pre-roll, then it means you're getting this podcast through Mevio. I'm in the process of disengaging from Mevio, so let me urge any Mevio listeners to go directly to shrinkwrapradio.com to get this show, or to click on our iTunes link where you can subscribe to it directly in iTunes. And if you are a listener and not a subscriber, please do become a subscriber. It costs you nothing. It just means you get a more automatic delivery of the show, and it helps me to have some idea of the size of my audience. The easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes, and there's a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Now, last time I mentioned that longtime listener, Alex Reisdorf, wrote suggesting that I solicit potential questions from you, the listeners. I have an interview scheduled with Dr. Richard Davidson, who's one of the major researchers using brain imaging to study meditators. He's a very high-profile guy and has had to postpone our interview 3 times now. Currently, we are scheduled for an interview on January 11th. So if you're interested, I encourage you to go online, read up on him a bit and his work, and then send me one or more questions that you'd like me to ask him, and maybe I'll use them. I mentioned that last time I heard from several listeners who had difficulty downloading number 225, my interview on the neuroscience of meditation with Harvard researcher Sarah Lazar. I finally figured out what was behind that technical glitch, and you should have no problem downloading it now. Let me remind you to visit our new Shrink Wrap Radio store. You'll see a tab for it at the top of the page. Currently, we're offering Shrink Wrap Radio logo t-shirts and my new CD compilation of 30 interviews related to dreams and depth psychology. For some reason, our number of subscribers seems to have taken a dip. So please help us to grow our audience by telling your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, your Twitter. And we seem to be gathering more friends on Twitter. You can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. We've been having a very lively discussion on our Yahoo discussion group about cellular memory after organ transplants. You know, the idea that somebody gets a heart transplant and suddenly they have a taste for foods that they never had before but that the donor had. Well, let me remind you to join our Yahoo discussion group. There is a banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Several people have generously responded to my recent pleas for transcriptionists, so we'll be putting up transcripts for more shows in the coming weeks. And have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, I think. Please contact me if you'd like to join our corps of volunteer transcribers. And speaking of things that support this effort, thanks to all of you who've made financial donations. As we go into this new year, please consider making a contribution, a 6-month or 12-month donation, using the big green donate button on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Your donations provide an important and predictable base, which is greatly appreciated.
Hi, this is positive psychology coach Dr. John Schinnerer with Guide to Self, and you are positively on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, positive psychology coach and author, Dr. John Schinnerer. John, whose work I recently discovered as I'm preparing my own course on positive psychology, will be my guest on the next episode. Now let's dip into our mailbag. First, congratulations go out to Brad Jacobson, Down Under, for admission into the graduate program of his choice. You might recognize Brad from, I believe he's a participant in our Yahoo discussion group, and also the model for the Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt that you'll see in connection with episode number 200. And Brad writes, "Hi, David. Thank you so very much. I've been accepted into the Master of Clinical Psychology program. If I maintain a high enough GPA during the first 2 years, I'll have the opportunity to articulate into the doctorate. At this point, I'm just completely stoked to get into the program. I would say that it's quite difficult to get a place here in Australia. I've heard that roughly 10% of applicants are offered a place. Clinical psychology has become a highly sought-after profession in recent years. In 2006, the government began a mental health initiative through which citizens/residents are offered rebates on up to 12 sessions a year with a psychologist, provided they are assessed by a GP and given a referral. Consequently, the profession has been given a major boost. Sessions with clinical psychologists are rebated at a rate of around 2 times that of any other specialist. So, as you can imagine, clinical psychology qualifications are now in high demand. This was, of course, not my motivation for doing the course, by the way. I will be attending Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, where I attended my 4th year, also known as honors, although this was actually my 5th year of university study. Queensland University of Technology has what I believe to be the second best clinical psychology program in the state behind the University of Queensland. The department takes a quite integrative, broad theoretical approach, which I like. The only downside is that I live about 1.5 hours north along the coast and will most likely need to rent accommodation in the city during the week. So yeah, exciting times ahead. Now I have to apply to the psychology board for probationary registration and hope they don't have a problem with my having completed my undergraduate degree having been conferred over 7 years ago. I have had to complete a fair bit of additional paperwork as a result of this. It would be very unfortunate to be penalized or refused registration for taking the time to mature and ultimately make an informed, thoughtful choice about my career. I will be an extremely motivated and dedicated student, giving the course 110%. 5 years ago, that certainly would not have been the case. And then he closes with, "Best, Brad." So congratulations to you, Brad. That's quite an achievement. Keep us posted on your progress. Now next we hear from Julia, who writes, "Hi there, Dr. Van Nuys. My name is Julia, and I'm a new listener to your wonderful podcast, Shrink Wrap Radio. My first podcast was the one you did with Michael Mead, and I have to tell you that I found it to be profound and perhaps even life-changing. We shall see. I'm not sure if this is the correct email for you, but I really wanted to send you this interview with Miriam Greenspan, where she talks about transformative emotions and the fertility of dark feelings. This seems like something you've probably already heard about, but I thought I would pass it along anyway. She'd be an interesting guest for your show." And Julia provides a link at thesumamagazine.org. She goes on to say, "My most recent podcast was the one about the man who got his PhD while living in Patagonia. Fascinating. I attended UBC for my undergrad and live in Vancouver. Warm regards, Julia." And of course, Julia there is referring to the interview with Robert Cole. And I have not heard of Miriam Greenspan, but I'll try to take a listen and consider her for the future. Next, we hear from Erica, who writes, "Hi, David. I'm still really loving the podcast. Podcast number 203, The Feminine Face of God with Sherry Ruth Anderson, especially knocked my socks off. I also was very intrigued by the work of Sarah Hannah Radcliffe and was delighted that you did 2 interviews with her. I have also listened to several of your interviews that dealt with dreams and found those extremely helpful. You're doing a great service by getting such great info to people who ordinarily wouldn't have access to it. Just out of curiosity, have you put any feelers out on getting an interview with Byron Katie or had a chance to check out the work? I know you've got lots of potential interviewees, but I think she'd be a fantastic one. Best, Erica." And I have not put out a feeler for Byron Katie yet. I know that she is a very popular author, and that's something I'll have to look into. Finally, here's a dream from Bob, who suggested the interview with dream analyst Jane Teresa Anderson. Unfortunately, Bob's submission was too late for that interview. Here's his dream, though, and all you amateur dream sleuths can take a crack at it. "Dr. Dave, here is a dream submission for the interview that you're doing with Jane Teresa Anderson. I hope this is not too late. Do you or Jane need any more details? I was taking some course, seemed like it was either in or on another language, that I could only speak partly, maybe French. I saw a need in one of the students who was somehow kind or doing something nice for others in the class, and I presented to her something that could help her. Maybe it was just an extra notebook or something, not sure. A bunch of us, students in the class, went for a walk out into the streets of the city. We were studying in an interesting building that was from an older, perhaps British colonial time. I noticed that one could walk up an incline and actually get onto the roof of the building to an area that may have been a rooftop viewing area in the past, but everything up there was boarded up, didn't look like one could get there from within the building anymore. Our group was a little later, still together, but now we were in a vehicle, almost seemed SUV-like, and we were following someone, seemed like the teacher from the class. There were hordes of military vehicles in the traffic, all different kinds of tanks. I saw some military officer checking over some soldiers. All the vehicles seemed to be tanks. They were completely covered over, that is, no open vehicles. We lost the teacher or whoever we were following. We turned right and found at the end of a short dead end a space that opened up below, maybe an indoor market in an old temple. There was a roof over everything, including our higher vantage point. We found ourselves in a restaurant, third world-like setting, seemed Indonesian or something like that. I bought an unpriced sandwich with some dollars, U.S. or Canadian, in my pocket. I had to get a sticker marked sandwich that was mislabeled on a donut to show the price. I got a lot of coins and a few bills and foreign currency back. We wandered around, and after a lowly cleaner cleaned up around us, I decided to reach in and give him my coins as a kind of tip. But before I could give them to him, an aggressive man interrupted, apparently demanding the coins himself. But behind him was an overweight, foreign Asian woman. She was the real boss of this little local mafia that must be controlling things. He/she were pressed up against me, demanding the coins. I offered half to them, half to the cleaner. They pressed for the coins. She said to me in English, "You are like a child." I responded confidently, "If so, what's wrong with that?" Finally, they accepted half the coins. I sat down, thinking that the cleaner was likely going to get beaten up later for his half of the coins. I worried that him getting the coins was therefore a disadvantage. Perhaps he would have been better off never seeing me in the first place. Well, as I mentioned, this was too late to send to Jane Teresa Anderson, but I did reply to Bob's email, and here's what I wrote. "Hi, Bob. I'm afraid this dream is too late for the interview. I did the interview yesterday. I realize now I should have announced a deadline for submission. So instead of hearing from Jane Teresa Anderson, I'll share a couple of my own quick impressions. I'm struck by the fact that kindness and concern for others runs throughout the dream. Is this one of your dominant concerns? I'm also struck by the contrast of opposites between the very high roof on the one hand and the space that opened up below on the other. In some way, I'm guessing that you have concerns or experience a tension between the, quotes, the higher, which might be either spiritual or intellectual, and the lower. The spiritual, in my view, is further reinforced by the reference to the temple, as well as the concern for the street sweeper. The, quotes, lower might be aggressive urges, as reflected in the military vehicles. I'm also interested in the teacher/student dichotomy and suspect this is an important aspect of your inner world, if not your outer one. In addition, there's so much in the dream that is foreign/exotic. I'm wondering what, if anything, is seeming especially foreign in your life right now. Does any of this connect or suggest possible avenues?" And I would also add that to that earlier response that I'd be particularly intrigued by the Asian woman who says, "You are like a child." Jung put great store in the significance of actual quotes in dreams. So I would be asking myself, in what ways am I like a child? Why is my dream calling my attention to this at this time? Is there some place where I need to be more grown up at this point in my life? And so that will wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area after each episode. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. I'd like to hear more of your voices. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Rick Johnson, for sharing about reclaiming our real selves. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will feature an interview with positive psychology coach and author, Dr. John Shinnerer. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying Happy New Year, and it's all in your mind.